I sniffed the air, but there's no trace of his cologne. He couldn't have been inside. I was in the garage for less than 5 minutes. I pressed my fingers against my eyes, trying to hold myself together, trying to think rationally amidst the panic racing through me. I enter the kitchen and nearly step in the puddle of Diet Coke, which has spread out from the tipped over can, traveling all the way toward the shelves and under it. My eyes follow the path, catching on the cast wheels of the shelving unit. I bend farther down, being careful not to kneel in it, and peer underneath, where the Coke has pooled up against the bottom edge of a doorframe. I circle around to the end of the unit, pushing it forward until I'm looking at a door with a padlock looped through a steel hinge. "What the hell, Eva?" I mutter. I grab her keys again and find the one that pops the lock. And when the door opens, I feel around on the wall for a light switch, turning it on. A fan below me begins to whir, and I creep down a small set of stairs that leads into a tiny basement that might have been a laundry room at one point. But it's not a laundry room anymore. Counters and shelves line the walls, with a small sink and portable dishwasher in the corner. Ingredients are arranged on the shelves, large containers of calcium chloride, at least 30 bottles of various cold and cough medications, a camping stove sits in the corner, several silicone pill molds upturned next to the sink, as if to dry. High above me in the wall is a boarded up window, the fan centered in it, spinning. To the left of the stairs is a counter strewn with papers and a voice recorder next to them. I lean over, reluctant to touch anything, and begin reading what appears to be a notarized letter to someone named Agent Castro. "My name is Eva James, and this is a sworn statement of events beginning October of 2007, all the way through the present, January 15th of this calendar year." I read quickly, the pages turning faster, the story of a college student who just wanted to fit in, who took the only option she believed was available at the time, latching onto a man named Dex, who promised her things he had no intention of ever giving her, a life, happiness, freedom. It's the story of a woman who was tired of the corner she'd been forced into, a woman ready to burn it all down on her way out. Eva wasn't a con artist or an identity thief. She was a woman like me, for whom the world will never bend, trying to set her path straight. I pick up the voice recorder and press play. The sound of a sports arena fills the small space. Chants and cheers, an announcer's voice, a marching band of some kind. "Seems kind of dangerous to get rid of the guy who was Brittany's contact," Eva's voice, just as I remember it. "Won't that draw the attention of the police again?" A familiar voice, one I heard not 10 minutes ago on the porch, warning me not to leave my front door unlocked, answers her.
"They'll never find him. Fish has a warehouse in Oakland, some kind of import-export bullshit. There's an incinerator in the basement."
I stop the recording, unable to listen anymore, like scenes flipping faster and faster, images appear in my mind. The cash purchase of her home, Eva's desperation at the airport. The way she shoved her purse into my arms without even looking through it to see if there was something she wanted to keep, the phone she had with her, and the black one she left behind. No wonder Eva didn't tell me the truth. This is why she couldn't return to Berkeley. And why I need to get out of here, now. I leave the lab untouched, but I gather the paperwork and the voice recorder, pressing them close to my chest as I sprint up the stairs.
Eva, Berkeley, California, February, 2 days before the crash. Eva was meeting Agent Castro at the Roundhouse, a diner that sat at the entrance of the Golden Gate Bridge on the San Francisco side. She parked down by Chrissy Field and walked up, checking over her shoulder several times as she made her way along the shaded paths of the Presidio. She'd taken the long way into the city, through San Rafael and Mill Valley, instead of crossing over on the Bay Bridge, hoping she wasn't followed. A letter had arrived from Liz the day before. Eva touched the folded edges of it like a talisman, pulling it from her pocket again to read. "Eva, I'm so sorry we didn't get a chance to say goodbye. I had really hoped we could talk one more time before I left. I feel like I owe you an apology. I made some assumptions that I shouldn't have, so I'm going to spell it out for you just so we're clear. There are no conditions on my friendship. I don't expect you to be anyone other than who you are. Whatever your past is, I accept it. Whoever you want to be, I will still love you. When you share your problems with someone else, your load gets lighter. And so I'm here, whenever you're willing to share what's troubling you. Just because I'm no longer next door doesn't mean I won't be there when you need me. Call me anytime. And then she'd scribbled a phone number at the bottom. Eva tucked the note back into her pocket where she'd been carrying it since its arrival, wishing she'd met Liz all those years ago instead of Dex, wondering how different her life would have been if all she'd had to confess was one bad mistake in the chemistry lab. She could see how that might have been something Liz could forgive. Eva had been young and stupid. She certainly wasn't the first person to do something dumb for a guy. But it was too late now. Liz was gone, and soon Eva would be too. Maybe it was better this way. She found Castro sitting in the back near the kitchen, away from the giant windows that overlooked the bridge. "I ordered you a burger and fries," he said by way of a greeting. She dropped her bag on the seat and slid across from him. The red vinyl booths were filled with tourists taking photographs with their cell phones. In the parking lot outside, a tour bus unloaded, and a crowd of people made their way toward the walking side of the bridge. Nerves slipped through her, like long ribbons twirling and twisting into tight knots, as she imagined leaving from there, exiting the restaurant and climbing into an anonymous sedan and disappearing. Her fingers tapped the table, her leg jiggling beneath her. "Thanks," she said. "But I'm not really interested in a meal and small talk, if that's okay with you." Agent Castro nodded. "My supervisor denied the request for witness protection," he said. Eva felt the air rush out of her, the sounds around them growing sharper, the clatter of plates and cutlery, the steady drone of conversations. All of her plans dissolved and vanished, as if they'd never existed. "Why?" she managed to ask. "You told me yourself you'd been after Fish for years." Agent Castro took a packet of sugar from the small cup at the edge of their table and traced the edges of it with his fingers, unable to meet her eyes. "I happen to agree with you, but like I said, witness protection is expensive, and we don't do it very often."
"When do you do it then?"
He looked up at her, and she saw genuine regret in his eyes.
"We use it mostly for big targets, organized crime, major networks. I know Fish feels like a big target to you, and he certainly is for me. I've been close to him more times than I care to admit, and every time he slips away, my contact goes dark and I'm back at square one."
"All the more reason to make this happen," she said, working hard to keep her voice low, to not let the desperation she felt break through.
"I can offer you 24-hour protection at an undisclosed location, all the way through the trial. I promise you'll be safe. If you have an attorney, now would be the time to call them."
Eva sat with his words, let them assemble into a picture. Her, alone in a hotel room, two guards at the door, an armed escort to and from the trial that would surely result in a not guilty verdict, or a mistrial. And then what? She'd be free to go back home? To unlock her front door and do what? Wherever she went, Fish's people would find her. Dex would probably do the job himself. After a betrayal like this one, he wouldn't rest until he'd found her. When she was a child, the girls in the group home would go to Sister Bernadette for advice with a problem. A friendship gone bad, an unfair teacher, a foster home that hadn't worked out. Eva never had, but she'd listened all the same, sliding herself along the edges of their conversations, absorbing whatever wisdom Sister Bernadette had to offer. She would often tell them, "The only way out is through.
That no matter the situation, one step would lead to the next, and the next one after that. And so Eva leaned into this new development, wrapped her mind around it, and got to work thinking through to the other side. She found it ironic that both Sister Bernadette and Dex offered her such similar advice. Play through. Then I guess we move forward and hope for the best, she said. What do you need? Castro tucked the sugar back into its cup as the waitress brought their food, the smell of the burger and fries turning her stomach sour. Ideally, we'd like to put a wire on you and have you meet with Fish. That's impossible, she said. I've never met him. It would be a huge red flag if I asked you now. Castro stared at her as if he didn't believe her. This whole deal goes away if you start lying to me. Gone was the apologetic tone, the regret he felt at not being able to do more for her. I'm not lying to you, she said. That's not how things work. I've been trying to find out more, how the drugs are moved, about Fish himself, but I don't know much more than my small corner of it. Castro sat back in his seat, both hands flat on the table. Finally, he said, We have proof, Eva. Photographs of the two of you together. Eva shook her head, confused. That's not possible, she said. I swear, I've never met him. Castro reached into his coat for his phone and flipped through photos until he found what he was looking for. Then he held it up so she could see the screen. It had been taken at Haas, the night she was supposed to meet Jeremy. She recognized the people around them, the sad accountant and his frayed sweatshirt at the end of the row. And there, in the middle of the frame, were Eva and Dex, their heads bent toward each other, deep in conversation. The quality was incredible. The shot must have been taken with a high-powered lens. She shook her head again, unwilling to believe what she was seeing. That's not Fish. That's Dex. Castro pulled the phone back and stared at her, squinting as if he didn't quite believe her. I don't know who Dex is, but that man is Felix Agros. Fish.
Claire. Sunday, February 27th. I sprint up the stairs and through the kitchen, my shoes tracking Diet Coke into the living room, stuffing Eva's sworn deposition and voice recorder into my bag. I don't know what compelled me to take them, what instinct warned me that leaving them behind would be a mistake. My mind flashes back to the man on the porch, how close he stepped, the scent of cigarette smoke still tickling the back of my throat. And I know without a doubt these papers, this recorder, are what he's after. Then I think of Eva's cell phone sitting on the kitchen table, Danielle's message still on it. I scurry back to grab it, shoving it into my pocket. Outside, a car drives by, the radio a faint thump as it passes. And I peek through the curtains, thinking about who might be out there, watching from the shadows. I have to force myself to open the door and step onto the porch, my instincts in disarray, unsure whether I risk more by leaving or staying. But in my mind, I see the basement drug lab. A notarized letter to a federal investigator and a man who is most certainly not a DEA agent, leaning in too close, a silent promise that he'll be back. I cross the lawn quickly, keeping my head down as I walk toward campus, bracing myself for a voice or a hand on my shoulder to stop me. In the distance, a cat yowls, long and low, then rises into a scream that sounds almost human. I find a small motor court motel on a busy street about a mile from campus. My shoulders ache, my feet hurt, and I'm freezing. A light burns in the small office, revealing an older woman smoking a cigarette and staring at a television mounted on the wall. When I enter, she turns to face me, her eyes squinting through a cloud of smoke. I'd like a room, please. It's $85 a night plus tax, she tells me. That's fine, I say, although I wobble a little as I do the math. She gives me a once-over and says, I'll need your name, your driver's license, and a credit card. I'd like to pay cash.
Doesn't matter. We have to enter the card into our system. We won't run it until you check out, and if you want to pay cash then, we won't run it at all.
I consider arguing with her, but I don't want to solidify myself in her memory. I hand over Eva's driver's license and her credit card, anxious as I watch her enter them into her computer, waiting for the tiniest hesitation, perhaps just her eyes, a slight widening, then flicking back up to my face. But she taps in the number, her expression bored, before handing everything back.
How many nights? She asks.
I can't think past this moment, the days stretching ahead of me, blank, with no idea what I'll do next.
I don't know. One? Two?
At $85 a night, my money will run out quickly.
I'll put you down for two,
the woman says, handing me a key.
Room 5, just out the door and to your left. Checkout is at 11. If you're here past that, we charge you for another night.
The room is small, with cheap carpeting on a polyester bedspread on the double bed that faces a television on a small bureau. A tiny desk and lamp are in the corner next to the bathroom. I sit on the bed and try to let the last few hours drain out of me. The clock on the nightstand reads 11:30 and my head is heavy with fatigue. The party in the Berkeley Hills feels like it happened a month ago instead of just a few hours. I lean forward, covering my face with my hands, and choke down a sob. I have no name, no plan, and not nearly enough money. My eyes are gritty with exhaustion. It's been 2 days since I've had any real sleep, and I fall back on the bed, fully dressed, and close my eyes, hoping tomorrow brings a solution. I wake early, having slept so deeply I didn't even dream. As I look around the room in the early morning light, I let my mind adjust to this new reality. My entire life exists within these walls. Outside, I'm either a dead woman or a drug dealer on the run. I sit up, my muscles screaming from 2 nights in a row of heavy catering work, and I think of Kelly already working her shift in the coffee shop, imagining me driving toward the heat of the desert. I wish I were there with her, sitting in one of the deep chairs while she makes idle conversation from behind the counter. I ache for the simplicity of it, to have a place in the world where I belong. My stomach growls, so I grab my NYU hat and some cash and dart down to the corner mart with $10 I can't afford to spend and return with an enormous cup of coffee and a package of stale cinnamon buns. My only option, weak as it is to find something on the thumb drive I can use against Rory to trade for my freedom, a secret he cares more about keeping than he does about punishing me. I turn the TV on for company and slowly set up my computer, plugging in the thumb drive and looking through the desk for the Wi-Fi directions. When I'm logged in, a quick check of Rory's email shows nothing new, but when I click over to the dock, a jolt like a lightning bolt shoots through me. Rory has typed, "How the fuck did she do it?" Bruce answers,
"I don't know. The airline said she was scanned onto the flight. No one disputed that.
They said her seat was empty. Do you think they know?"
"I think they would have contacted you immediately if they thought there was any chance she wasn't on the plane. Do you want me to tell them?"
Rory's words come fast, his anger nearly leaping off the screen.
"Absolutely not. I'm going to handle this quietly. Let the NTSB keep thinking she's dead. I've scheduled the plane for Oakland tonight."
Just as quickly as the words appeared, they disappear again, line by line, until I'm looking at a blank dock. The top reading, "Last edit made by Bruce Corcoran." Bruce's icon vanishes, leaving only Rory's behind. I know what Rory means when he says, "I'm going to handle this quietly." It means he's going to make a problem disappear out of view of the public. And I've given Rory the perfect cover to do whatever he wants to me, because the whole world already thinks I'm dead. I feel the walls closing in, Danielle, Rory and Bruce tracking my every movement, forcing me into a smaller and smaller box until I'm trapped with only one way out. A banging on a door across the courtyard startles me, causing my elbow to slip forward, knocking my coffee toward the keyboard. I jump, trying to grab it before it tips, a small amount spilling on the surface of the desk, but in my haste to save the coffee, I accidentally press a few keys, Shit, I say, hurrying to delete what I typed, my eyes leaping again to the top right corner, hoping Rory logged off when Bruce did. I stare at the screen for what feels like an hour, but must have only been a few minutes. No new text appears, but at the top of the page it now reads, "Last edit made by Rory Cook 2 minutes ago." And I pray neither of them will remember who wiped the dock clean. In the bathroom, I splash cold water on my face, the cheap fluorescent lighting making my skin look haggard and washed out. I brace my arms on the counter and try to regroup. Deep breath in, deep breath out, 5, 8, 10 times. I bring my attention to the way the faucet drips around the rust-edged drain, the repeating swirl of fake granite, before facing myself back to work. Seated in front of my computer again, the weight of futility settles across my shoulders. I'm unsure of what to look for or where to start. Should I look for more about Charlie? Or maybe some kind of financial or tax fraud? The problem is I don't know enough about finance to recognize anything that might be useful. I'm about to double-click on the thumb drive when my eye catches again on the alert at the top of the dock. Last edit made by Rory Cook 2 minutes ago. A quick check of the time tells me it's been at least 10. I hit refresh, expecting to see the time update, but instead, I'm redirected back to the Gmail login page. No, I whisper into the room. I retrieve the crumpled post-it note with Rory's password from Eva's wallet and enter it again, but it fails. I try once more, slower this time. But again, it tells me the password is incorrect. I picture Rory seated at his desk, having just watched the video of me stepping between Donnie and Cressida, my poorly executed cut-and-dye job, barely a disguise at all. And then, unbidden, text appearing on his screen with his own name attached. I can see him calling Bruce, demanding to know how someone might have accessed his account. And then I see his horror when he realizes the only person who would have had the opportunity to steal his password and a vested interest in watching him is me. I stand and press my fists against my eyes, tears seeping through the creases. I can't do this, I whisper into the empty room. I can't. I open my eyes and grab the wallet, the nearest thing to me, and hurl it against the wall. The change purse pops open, a cascade of pennies and dimes falling down the wall and burying themselves somewhere behind the dresser, while the wallet itself lands with a thump on the surface. But something inside of me loosens, the sudden action releasing just enough anxiety like a pressure valve, yanking me back to center, the dingy room coming back into focus. I don't have the luxury of falling apart. Rory knows I've been watching him. Listening in on conversations he believed were private, watching his panic over what Charlie knows about Maggie Moretti. There has to be some way I can use that. Behind me, Kate Lane's voice catches my attention. A little less than a week ago, Flight 477 crashed into the waters off of Florida. 96 people perished in the crash, and investigators are one step closer to figuring out what happened with the recovery of the black box. The screen cuts to old footage, the same bobbing Coast Guard boats, the same pieces of floating wreckage they showed last week. Vista Airlines officials declined to comment on rumors that flight attendants failed to confirm the total number of passengers with a head count, but anonymous sources inside Vista Airlines report that this is not unusual when flights are delayed. Airline officials say they have confidence that the manifest was accurate, that the number of passengers matched all flight records. I freeze, absorbing this information, thinking back to the thread I read, the commenter who was so certain a person couldn't get scanned onto a flight without actually getting on it because of the headcount. But now I see that Eva might have done it. A laugh, incredulous and tickling, tumbles around inside of me. And I sit back in my chair, trying to imagine her out there in some anonymous hotel room, watching this same report, having somehow slipped off the plane and vanished. I think about the risks Eva took to gather the notes and the recordings, things that implicated her alongside whoever that man was on her porch. and I wonder what went wrong. Why she didn't turn it over. Whatever it was, it had her running, unable to return home. And I wonder what she'd want me to do with it. I stare at the wall, though I'm looking beyond what's in front of me to the image of Eva, laughing and running away from me, backlit and growing smaller the farther away she gets. I watch her until she's just a dot. Just a nothing. Almost gone. I trace the edge of the thumb drive with my finger, certain there are secrets there Rory wants to keep hidden. I just don't know what they are. But Rory doesn't have to know that. As if Eva were whispering in my ear, an idea begins to unfurl, outrageous and bold. But it will require me to come out of hiding and confront him, to pick up a phone and dial his number, telling him what I have. Embellishing and fabricating across the blank spots, weaving just enough of a story to make him believe I know more. Not just about Charlie, but the contents of the hard drive, wrapped up and ready to deliver to the media and authorities, unless he gives me what I want. And yet, the idea of calling him, of hearing his voice on the other end of the line, like a hook drawing him toward me, makes me shudder. Because if I'm wrong, and this doesn't work, it will make everything worse. I pick up Eva's cell phone, glad I brought it with me, a way to contact him without revealing my exact location, but I hesitate before turning it on. My instincts still snagging on how Danielle managed to track down the number and what else they might already know. Whether she's out there waiting for me to make another mistake. I take a deep breath and let it out slowly. Then power it on. Immediately, another voice message pops up along with a text. My finger hesitates, unsure which to click on first, before deciding on the voicemail. Mrs. Cook, it's Danielle again. I don't blame you for not trusting me, but you have to believe I'm trying to help you. Mr. Cook is on his way to California, and I'm fairly certain it's because he knows you're there. I'm texting you a recording from yesterday. Use it. I'll back you up. I stare at the phone, my mind traveling in 20 different directions, picking through her words, trying to see the trick. What she really wants me to do. Because after all the times she'd looked away, stayed silent when she could have spoken up, I have a hard time believing she wants to help me now. I open the text, which is a voice memo file titled Recording 1. I grab the remote and mute the TV, then press play. Muffled voices fill my motel room, arguing. I realize it's Rory and Bruce, though I can't make out their words. Then there's a knock on the door and Rory's voice calling. Come in. Danielle's voice, closer, says.
Sorry to bother you, but I need your signatures on these forms.
Of course, Rory says. Thank you, Danielle, for handling all of the details with the NTSB. I know how much you loved and respected Mrs. Cook.
There's so much I wish I could have done differently, Danielle says.
I hear the rustle of papers, then Rory's voice again.
That should do it. Please close the door on your way out.
Danielle's voice sounds farther away as she says,
No problem, Mr. Cook. Thank you.
Then an opening and closing door. I expect the recording to end there, but it doesn't. Rory's voice speaks again, a shade colder.
What have you found out?
Bruce finally speaks.
In 1996, he says, as if reading from a file, Charlie Price, or rather Charlotte, as she prefers to be called now, was arrested for possession with the intent to sell. They couldn't make it stick, and the charges were dropped.
I hear a page turn.
She moved to Chicago, where she worked as a waitress, seemed to stay out of trouble. She still lives there.
Charlotte? She? Charlie's a woman?
Anything else?
Rory asks.
Not really. No husband, boyfriend, or girlfriend. No kids. Family seems to be either dead or estranged. Nothing we can use as motivation.
Bruce's voice grows softer.
Nothing we've said so far has swayed her. Not money, not threats. She insists on telling the truth. Rory's voice is low, dangerous, and cold, sending a chill rippling through me.
And what does she claim to be the truth?
That you and Charlie were having an affair behind Maggie's back. That you were there when Maggie died, and you timed the fire to start after your departure. That you showed up at Charlie's apartment, frantic and shaking like a leaf. A pause. When Bruce continues, I can barely hear him.
She doesn't care about the NDA she signed. She doesn't care about anything we've offered.
That's not acceptable, Rory yells, and I recoil as if he were in the room yelling at me. This will derail everything. You have 2 days to make this problem disappear. I hear Bruce gathering things, collecting papers, the snap of a briefcase latch.
Understood, he says.
Footsteps, the sound of a door opening and closing, then silence. I'm about to stop the recording when I hear another knock on the door.
Enter,
Rory says. Danielle again. I'm so sorry to bother you. I think I dropped my phone somewhere. May I come in and look? A grunt from Rory. Here it is. It must have fallen. And the recording ends. I sit on the bed, stunned. There's so much I wish I could have done differently, Danielle had said, the words spinning a different meaning now that I know she was saying them to me, offering an acknowledgement, and perhaps also an apology. That Danielle would risk so much to get this for me is astonishing. All those years of scrambling behind me, of meticulously keeping me on schedule. I thought she was just another arm of Rory controlling me. Perhaps if I'd bothered to turn around and really look at her, I'd have seen something else. Not someone intent on bringing me down, but a woman desperately trying to prop me up. I listen again to Danielle's message, to the urgency in her voice, the way it cracks, the whispered edges of fear. Use it. I'll back you up. On the silent television screen, two political commentators are talking, their lips moving soundlessly. Across from them, Kate Lane says something to the camera, then smiles. I turn up the volume in time to hear the familiar tune for Politics Today fading into commercial. It's unreal that just a week earlier, I was making the final preparations for my Detroit trip, imagining a life as Amanda Burns, living peacefully in Canada. And how quickly things went wrong, landing me here instead, pressed between the secrets Eva was keeping, forced to dance between landmines I can't even see. I'm not going to call Rory. Threats will never work on him. If they did, I would have used them long ago. What Danielle has sent me is so much better. Rory's voice, Rory's anger, packaged into the perfect soundbite. I Google the email address for Kate Lane, then go to the Gmail homepage and set up a new email account and draft my email. The words coming effortlessly. When I'm done, I hesitate. The minute I send it, everything will be set into motion. There will be no way for me to go back. But this is the only trick left in my bag. I reread the email one final time. Dear Ms. Lane, my name is Claire Cook, and I am Rory Cook's wife. I did not die on Flight 477, as has been previously reported. I am in California, and I have recently received evidence that implicates my husband in the death and cover-up of Maggie Moretti. I would like to speak with you about it at your earliest convenience. And then I hit send.
Eva, Berkeley, California, February, 2 days before the crash. Dex was Fish. Fish was Dex. Eva felt her reality shift, pieces sliding into place in a different order, a different picture, as panic and confusion pounded through her. What had she missed? What hadn't she seen? Didn't you wonder why you'd never met Fish? Why Dex was your only contact? Castro asked. I was told that's how it worked. I didn't question it. Eva shook her head. But why would Dex lie? She whispered. By allowing the people who worked for him to believe he was just carrying out orders from above, it gave him a measure of deniability.
It allowed you to trust him in a way you wouldn't have if you'd known he was the guy at the top.
Is this common? She asked. Don't people work really hard to earn that spot? Don't they want everyone to know what kind of power they have?
Agent Castro shrugged. Sometimes, he said. But to be honest, those types of dealers are pretty easy to catch. They're in for it for their ego. They want everyone to know how important they are. They want everyone to be afraid of them. But Fish.
Castro tipped his head toward her.
Or rather, Dex. Is what we call a long-term operator. Someone who cares more about longevity than anything else. More than power. More than fear. They're smarter and harder to pin down.
Castro took a sip of his coffee and continued.
I've only seen this once before. A woman up in El Cerrito who pretended she had a husband who was calling the shots. She had her finger in a lot of things, mostly because people trusted her to keep them safe from a man who never even existed.
Eva thought about how Dex had put himself between her and Fish, how he protected her and warned her, led her to believe he was on her side, that they were working together. She thought back to how rattled he was at the football game last fall, how scared he'd been of angering Fish. All of it an elaborate act. And then her mind flew back to that early morning when he'd shown her the body. And events rearranged in her imagination as she saw Dex executing the man and then calmly walking to Eva's door, knocking, and leading her back again to show her what he'd done. She felt sick at how naive she'd been.
So now what? She asked. It's time for you to get an attorney and make a deal. We'll put a wire on you and see what we can get.
Eva thought of all she'd gathered and tucked that knowledge close, her final card to play. There was no way she was going to wear a wire. And what do I get in exchange? She asked, since witness protection is not an option.
You get to not go to jail when this is all over.
On the table, Eva's phone buzzed with a text. And her gaze flew to Castro's phone, wondering whether it too would light up. But it remained dark.
You'd better answer that, he said.
It was from Dex.
Are we set for six? Where do you want to meet?
She showed it to Agent Castro.
Stick to public places where my people can blend in, he advised. From now on, I don't want you to be alone with him, or anywhere we can't get to you quickly. No more sports arenas, no more deserted parks. My team will stay on you until we can get the wire set up. 1-2 days tops.
Eva took her phone back and with trembling fingers typed, O'Brien's? I'm starving. She imagined driving back across the bay and sitting across the table from Dex, forcing herself to act normal while she waited for Castro to line up his fucking wire guy. Castro must have sensed her rising panic because he said,
You're going to be okay. Just stick to your routine and do everything you normally would. Make the drugs, meet with Dex. Don't give him any reason to be alarmed.
Through the window, Eva could see fog rolling in, the bright orange of the bridge fading before her eyes, and she worried that would happen to her. She'd grow so faint, she would disappear from the page and no one would know she'd been there at all. The restaurant hummed with conversation, the sound of cutlery against dishes filling her ears, the whole world moving around her while she stood still. I don't have a choice, do I?
Castro's eyes softened with sympathy. You really don't.
Eva was halfway across the Bay Bridge when she began to hyperventilate, cars on all sides inching forward, funneling her toward an inevitable outcome. No fucking way could she do this. She imagined herself driving north, passing the off-ramp to Berkeley, past Sacramento, Portland, and Seattle. She looked in her rearview mirror and studied the people in the cars behind her. Which ones were Castro's? Whoever was keeping an eye on her would never let her get that far. At home, she packed quickly, only taking the essentials, leaving the house as is. If anyone came looking for her, she wanted it to appear as if she'd just stepped out, that she'd be back any minute.
She thought of her lab downstairs, the tools and ingredients, the evidence she'd gathered for Castro, and decided to leave it. Eventually, he'd show up looking for her, and he was welcome to all of it. She was no longer going to play by anyone else's rules. Eva's plan was to park near O'Brien's, appear to be on her way to meet Dex, and then slip down into the BART station and catch the first train that came, to make her way back into San Francisco, pay cash for a bus ticket to Sacramento, and then figure out how to keep going. North, and then further north still, until she reached the border. But the sight of Liz's glass bluebird ornament on her dresser caused her to pull up short. She picked it up, running her finger over the swirls of blue, the delicate beak, the edges of the wings. The only thing that was ever given to her out of love, from the only person who ever truly cared about her. Eva thought about Wade, who had promised to take the blame. Dex, who pretended to be someone he wasn't so he could better manipulate her. And Castro, who'd expected her to do the impossible, but giving her nothing she needed in return. Men who made promises they never intended to keep. People like Eva were always going to be collateral damage. And then there was Liz, who saw her for who she was, the very best version of herself. She felt the outline of Liz's letter still in her pocket. When you share your problems with someone else, your load gets lighter. Like a rat in a maze, Eva's path was narrowing down to just one person she could trust. Eva grabbed her emergency cash, $5,000, and packed her computer, leaving her compromised cell phone on the counter. Then she slipped out of the house, still gripping the glass bluebird in her fist. The first train that arrived was crowded. She waited until the doors were closing before jumping on, looking toward the platform for any sign someone was following her. She imagined Castro's agents above her, moving out in an ever-widening circle with her car at the center, parked at a meter on Shattuck, wondering where she went, what happened to her. Eva scanned the faces of the people around her, silently discarding a man sleeping in a corner and a couple huddled over an iPad deep in conversation. But there is a woman directly across from her that Eva caught glancing at her as the train hurled south toward Oakland. She had a magazine open, but as Eva studied the ads above the woman's head, waiting for her to turn the page of her magazine, the woman remained motionless. At the next stop, Eva waited until the last second to slip off the train and watch the woman, still reading, slide past her and into the dark tunnel. She huddled in a corner of the station, her bag slung over her shoulder, watching commuters board and exit trains before picking another one, this time heading toward San Francisco. For the next hour, she transferred and backtracked until she was certain she was alone. At the airport, she paid cash for a red-eye ticket to Newark. "One way or round trip?" the ticket agent asked. Eva hesitated. Had Castro put her on some kind of list? Again, his words, mid-level target, flashed in her mind. "One way," she answered. The finality of it sent a shudder through her. If she was wrong, a one-way ticket would sound the alarm. She didn't relax until well after takeoff. As the passengers around her slept or read, Eva stared out the window, thinking of an evening just after Halloween, when she'd found Liz sitting on the back steps, looking out at their yard in the deepening twilight. "What are you doing back here?" she'd asked. Liz had looked up from where she sat and smiled. "I love the smell of the evening, when the sun has disappeared and everything starts to cool down, no matter how much life changes. This never does." She closed her eyes. "My ex-husband and I used to do this when we were first married. Sit outside and watch the sky change from day to night." Eva sat on her own step, looking at Liz through the iron bars of the railing. "Where is he now?" Liz shrugged and brushed her fingers along the edge of the concrete step. "Last I heard, he moved to Nashville
but that was 20 years ago. I have no idea if he's still there. Eva wondered how she could be so calm about the man who'd abandoned her with a young child and never looked back. Does Ellie ever hear from him?
I don't know. We don't really talk about him, but I don't think so. He sent cards for her birthday for a few years, but those stopped when she was still young.
Liz looked across the yard, to the back fence and the trees beyond. In a quiet voice, she said, "For a while, Ellie blamed me for that, as if I could make that man care about her. But now that she's grown, she can see him for who he really is, and understand her childhood was probably better without him in it."
Eva marveled at her calm tone.
"How can you not hate him?"
Liz gave a soft chuckle. "Hate can eat you up inside. I could devote hours a day to despising him, but it wouldn't matter. He's out there somewhere living his life, and if he thinks about us at all, it's probably only in passing. I decided a long time ago to forgive him, which is a lot easier than hating him."
Eva thought about the strength that must have taken, to raise her daughter on her own while still following her own dreams, to set the betrayal aside and choose to be happy.
"Have you always been this way? Able to see beyond the worst in people?"
Liz laughed. "It takes a long time to learn how to see the world as a place where people aren't doing things to you. My husband didn't set out to break my heart, or Ellie's. He was just acting on his own desires, living his own story. I hope I've become someone who doesn't get angry when others are just trying to get by. I hope I can be the kind of person who looks toward forgiveness first."
Eva stared across the yard toward the bushes by the back gate, their shadows quickly disappearing in the fading light.
"I'm not very good at forgiveness."
Liz nodded. "Not many people are. But what I've learned in life is that in order for true forgiveness to occur, something has to die first. Your expectations, or your circumstances, maybe your heart, and that can be painful. But it's also incredibly liberating."
"Is this your roundabout way of telling me I need to forgive my birth family?"
Liz had looked at her, surprised. "I think you need to figure out how to forgive yourself for whatever it is that still chases after you."
As Eva flew east, the window next to her a black square, she wondered if this was the death Liz was talking about. Her entire life, abandoned in Berkeley, just a hollow shell that no longer fit the person she was becoming. It didn't make sense even to her why she needed to see Liz one more time. But somehow she understood that this was how she'd forgive herself.
Claire, Monday, February 28th. While I wait for a reply from Kate Lane, I flip through the notes I took from Eva's lab, sinking again into the story of a chemistry prodigy, an outcast, and a drug dealer. When I'm done, I stare at the curtained window, the sound of distant traffic just beyond the door, and picture her out there, moving silently through crowds of students, shoulders hunched, hands shoved into the pockets of her green coat, head tucked into her chest, invisible. Her solitary life always holding her apart, never safe, never known. And I know why she decided to do what she did. I drink the rest of my cold coffee and eat the last cinnamon bun, wishing I could check the dock. I imagine Rory packing a bag and assembling a small team, coordinating with Bruce. A short trip to California for personal business. Danielle, quiet and watchful, taking notes, waiting for another opening to tell me what she knows. Just then, my email pings with a response from Kate Lane's production assistant. "Ms. Lane is definitely interested in this story. We will need to verify your claim before moving forward," she writes. "Please send a number where we can reach you so we can confirm you're who you say you are." I toggle over to the settings on Eva's phone, find her number, then type it directly into my email reply. 10 minutes later, the cell phone rings, and I leap for it. Hello? Mrs. Cook, it's Kate Lane.
The sound of my own name sounds odd to my ear, making me feel exposed.
Thank you for talking with me, I say.
Well, you tell an interesting story.
But first, I need you to explain how it is you aren't dead. When the NTSB says you got on that plane.
The years of silence pile up in me, the secrets I've guarded for so long, the belief that no one would want to know the truth. I start slowly, describing Rory's abuse and how desperate I was to leave him, how my plans to disappear in Detroit fell apart, and how Rory had discovered them. And then I met a woman at JFK. Her name was Eva James, and she agreed to trade flights with me, I say. When I landed, I found out the Puerto Rico flight had crashed. I've been stuck here with no money and no way to disappear, so I took a job with a catering company. I tell her about the TMZ video and how Rory was now on his way to California because of it.
So Eva James died in the crash instead.
I close my eyes, knowing I need to be careful. The best way I can protect Eva is to let the people who are after her believe she's dead.
She did.
Jesus, Kate breathes out. Then she seems to regroup.
I guess we'd better move on to Maggie Moretti.
I have a recording of my husband and his assistant, Bruce Corcoran. In it, they're discussing a woman named Charlotte Price, who has direct knowledge of my husband's involvement in Maggie Moretti's death. There's a pause as Kate Lane absorbs this information. When was this recording made? I'm not sure, I admit. In the last few days. My assistant made it and sent to me sometime last night. She's willing to verify its legitimacy.
Kate seems to think about this.
Before we do anything, I'll need to listen to it. Can you text it to my producer?
She rattles off a number and I send it off. Soon I hear it playing across the phone line. The knocking, Danielle's voice, then Rory and Bruce.
When it's done, Kate lets out a sigh, her voice gentle.
Mrs. Cook, I'm sorry. But I don't think we can put that on the air.
What do you mean? This was my last shot. I'd laid everything on the table, revealed where I was and what I'd done, and the outcome is still the same. He all but admits he was responsible.
It's not enough, Kate says. His assistant outlines the accusation, and while your husband doesn't deny it, it's not an admission.
He's on his way to California, I tell her. He knows what I've done. This is the only thing that might stop him. I want to help you, she says.
What you've told me is huge in its own right. An abused wife, a man about to run for Senate, two women meeting in an airport and switching tickets. Let me put you on the air to tell that story.
I swipe a hand across my eyes and say, and like all the other women who have come out against powerful men, I'll be the one ostracized while he sails on to Congress.
Your concern is valid, she says, but this will buy you time. While you tell your story, others can be working on the link between your husband and Maggie Moretti. Have your assistant send the recording to the New York District Attorney. We'll look for Charlotte Price and see if she wants to go on the record. If there's anything there, we'll find it.
I hear her shuffling more papers in the background and the sound of someone's muffled voice.
Let's get you over to our San Francisco studio while we work the phones on this end. Tell me where you are and I'll have a car sent over.
I tell her the name of the motel, feeling unsettled and agitated. Coming forward to talk about what Rory did to me wasn't what I wanted.
I'll be in touch if anything comes up, Kate says. The car should be there in about an hour. Be ready.
I will, thank you. I begin packing my things, shoving them into my bag haphazardly. By this time tomorrow, I'll be Claire Cook again, shouldering all the baggage that comes along with it, facing the circus my accusations will create. I think about Eva, out there somewhere, and hope that at least this might set her free. A knock on the door startles me, and I worry that Rory might have bumped his trip up, slipped out of New York without Danielle knowing, and somehow located me here. That by the time the CNN car arrives, there will be nothing but an empty room. I peek through the curtains and see a man, his arms folded across his chest, revealing a brief glimpse of a gun holster under his coat. I call through the door.
Can I help you?
He smiles and flashes a badge.
My name is Agent Castro,
he says. And I'd like to talk to you about Eva James.
Eva, New Jersey, February, one day before the crash. The plane bumped down at 2 o'clock in Newark after flying all night and an interminable layover in Chicago. After taxiing to the gate, Eva hurried up the jetway, stopping only to buy a new prepaid phone at a kiosk, tossing the packaging in the trash and dialing the number Liz had written at the bottom of her letter. "It's Eva," she said, relieved to find Liz at home. "I'm actually in New Jersey. Is it possible I can stop by?" "You're here. How? Why?" Liz's surprised voice floated through the line. "It's a long story," Eva said, passing through baggage claim and out into the frigid February air. "Can I tell you in person?" Just 20 miles from Manhattan, Liz's New Jersey street looked like it belonged in the Midwest, with small, well-cared-for houses, a mix of brick and painted stucco. When Liz opened her door, she pulled Eva into a tight hug. "This is such a surprise," she said. "Come in." She followed Liz through the house to a large room off the kitchen that overlooked a snowy backyard. An afternoon talk show was on the TV in the corner, and Liz switched it off, gesturing for Eva to sit on the couch. Liz perched next to her and said, "I've missed you. Tell me everything." Eva froze. The whole flight she'd rehearsed in the dark while people slept around her, tried to find the right place to begin unraveling it all. But now that she was looking into Liz's questioning eyes, waiting for Eva to say something, she couldn't make her mouth work at all. Her gaze traveled around the room to the bookshelves crammed with books, a messy desk covered in papers, and a couple half-emptied packing boxes in the corner. She took a deep breath and gave Liz a wobbly smile. "I don't know where to start," she told her. Liz took Eva's hands, warm and dry against Eva's sweaty ones, and she felt a little calmer, Liz's energy passing through her, making her heart rate slow. "Just pick a place and begin." "I'm in trouble," Eva said, her voice low and tentative. And then she began. She told Liz about Wade, how he made her feel special. Eva looked into her lap and shrugged. "It was the first time anyone had made me feel that way. Interesting, attractive, like a normal person living a normal life." She described the meeting in the dean's office, how no one showed up for her, and how she'd felt she had to accept their terms. They had all the power, all the leverage. "I was just a kid. It was easy for them to kick me out and pretend none of it happened." "Didn't the university appoint an advocate for you?" Eva had never even considered such a thing. She shook her head and Liz looked disgusted. "You could have appealed. There are procedures that should have been followed." But then Liz seemed to catch herself because she said, "You couldn't have known, and that doesn't help you now. Go on." Eva thought about what came next, a decision so significant, her entire life cleaved in two. She let out a slow breath, dragging out the moment, knowing she'd have to step forward and tell the rest, but not wanting to. Terrified Liz wouldn't understand. That what she'd said in her letter about accepting Eva as she was wouldn't apply to what she was about to confess. Eva was tempted to end the story there, tell Liz she was on her way to Europe, had a layover, and wanted to stop by and say hi. But she knew Liz wouldn't buy it, and eventually Castro would show up at Liz's door and tell her the truth. Eva needed to be the one to tell Liz, to make sure Liz understood why she'd done what she did. She prayed some of Liz's forgiveness would come her way. "That guy you saw me arguing with is named Dex, or at least that's the name I know him by. Apparently, he has others." Eva told her about Dex's offer, about how she had no money,
nowhere to go, and how it seemed like a lifeline at the time. As she spoke, Liz's eyes grew wider, her expression more and more shocked. Eva knew what Liz expected to hear. Typical problems such as a lost job, an unwanted pregnancy, maybe stolen money or property. But Eva could tell Liz didn't expect this. She couldn't bear the weight of Liz's eyes, and she leaned forward, resting her head in her hands, covering her face, elbows on her knees. Next to her, she felt Liz rise from the couch and move away from her. Eva held her breath, waiting for the sound of Liz opening her front door, a quiet voice asking Eva to leave, or the sound of her picking up the phone to call the police. But instead, she heard Liz move into the kitchen and open the refrigerator, the sound of ice, and she returned with a bottle of vodka and two glasses. She poured generously and took a drink. "Continue," she said. Eva sipped her vodka and told her the rest. Brittany, Agent Castro, the evidence she'd assembled, Castro's news that she didn't qualify for witness protection, and finally, that Dex was Fish. "I'm sure he knows by now that something is up. I was supposed to meet him yesterday, but I never showed." "You have to cooperate," Liz said when Eva had finished telling her everything. "It's the only thing you can do." She finished her vodka and poured another glass, topping off Eva's as well. "My God, Eva." "I can't. You have to," Liz insisted. "This is how you get your life back." Eva tried not to lose her temper. "It doesn't work like it does on TV. Even if Dex goes to jail, I'm still at risk. No matter where I go, his people will find me. I tried to make Agent Castro understand this, but he said his hands were tied." Eva began to cry, great hiccuping sobs, and Liz wrapped her arms around her, holding her tight. "You have to stop running," she said into the top of Eva's head. "Stop covering up lies with more lies." "It's not that simple," Eva said, pulling back and wiping her eyes. "Castro thinks I can testify and then somehow go back to my regular life, as if Dex would ever let me get that far. The only thing I can do is leave, disappear, and let Castro figure it out without me." She waited.